From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, manned US planes take to the skies of Nigeria in the hunt for the missing schoolgirls. We look at the pattern of abuse directed at the female population across the region.
Boko Haram, in my perspective, are the Taliban of Africa. They follow the same ideology, the same twisted, violent interpretation of Sharia law.
Also today, two staff at a hospital in Orlando show symptoms of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome after coming into contact with a patient infected by the virus. And why events in Ukraine are working to not only help the Russian president, but improve his international image.
He can now ease off the pressure and pretend to be the good guy, pretend to be the moderate, because he has already achieved what he wants.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Seven Ukrainian soldiers have been reportedly ambushed and killed as clashes continue in eastern Ukraine between pro-Moscow militants and Ukrainian forces. It's reported one separatist also died in the attack, which took place outside the town of Kramatorsk. Additionally, the European Union has signed a deal of 1 billion euros in macro financial support for Ukraine. The interim Ukrainian government met with the head of the European Commission in Brussels to discuss the ongoing crisis with elections in the country set for May 26th. Some 355 million euro of the money signed in this agreement will go to a Ukrainian state-building project to try and get industry moving. Ukraine's interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk says the country's ties with the EU remain strong.
The Ukrainian government is committed to implement and to execute the political part of this association agreement that was signed previously. And we will strongly recommend to the new president to sign DCFTA.
In Turkey, an electrical transformer explosion and fire at a coal mine has left a number dead and up to 300 others trapped underground. There were reportedly about 500 workers underground at the time of the explosion, but many were able to escape before becoming trapped. Some of the miners are now in hospital, seeking treatment for burns and smoke inhalation. As Laura Wells, a journalist in Turkey, describes, search and rescue operations are currently underway.
Well, they have four rescue teams working, and they're trying to pump fresh air into the mine shafts, which have not been affected by the fire. Of course, if you put oxygen on fire, you can actually spread the fire. But it's a very difficult effort since it's so far underground and so far away from the exit.
Nigerian officials say they are ready to negotiate with Islamist militant group Boko Haram on the release of the hundreds of kidnapped schoolgirls. Abubakar Shekau, head of Boko Haram, released a video yesterday showing a number of the girls and saying he would consider trading them for imprisoned members of his militant group. Nigerian Cabinet Minister Tanimu Taraki says Mr. Shekau should send representatives for talks to prove the offer is legitimate. Meanwhile, U.S. aircrafts have begun flying over northeast Nigeria to assist in the hunt for the girls. Daniel Wrenches reports.
The United States is flying manned intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance planes with the Nigerian government's permission, according to a U.S. official who also says they're sharing commercial satellite images. The U.S. and U.K. are now providing ground support to Nigerian search teams, and the U.S. is also providing intelligence experts and negotiators.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An underwater shipwreck expert reports he's discovered the remains of Christopher Columbus's ship, the Santa Maria, the flagship of his famous 1492 expedition to the Americas. The wreck is located off the coast of Haiti. The American investigator Barry Clifford says his team has been measuring and photographing the ruin and is working with the Haitian government to keep the site safe and protected. The United Nations Special Envoy to Syria has resigned following the failure of the peace talks. Lakhdar Brahimi is stepping down from his position at the end of May, but there's no clear replacement. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The Secretary General, flanked by Lakhdar Brahimi, confirmed the news that had been rumoured for some time. Ban Ki-moon said the UN mediator for Syria had faced almost impossible odds, and said he regretted that the Syrian government in particular had been so reluctant to take advantage of Mr. Brahimi's efforts to end the conflict. The Secretary General said he had to take some time to think about who would be the right person to replace Mr. Brahimi.
And the European Court of Justice has ruled Google and other search engines must erase links to irrelevant data on request. It's being known as the right to be forgotten test and was brought to the court by a Spanish man who said his privacy was being infringed because a Google search of his name brought up the auction of his repossessed home from 16 years ago. Jack Perrock has more.
The European Union is hailing it as a victory for the personal data protection of Europeans, while Google has said in the past that this move to allow people to have information about them online removed would actually amount to censorship. The ruling was given at the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg and will now be picked apart for exactly what this right to be forgotten will mean for search engines. It's part of a wider push by the EU to improve data protection for citizens.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. US military intelligence have begun flying manned surveillance missions over Nigeria in the hunt for more than 200 missing schoolgirls. The girls were kidnapped almost a month ago by the Islamist group Boko Haram. A video released on Monday shows dozens of girls in Muslim dress and the group's leader asking for a hostage exchange involving the release of jailed militant fighters. The Nigerian government says it's open to all options to secure the safe return of the captives. A team of some 30 US experts, including members of the FBI and Defense and State Departments, are bolstering the search operation. For more perspective on the actions of Boko Haram and the wider ideological threat to women in the region, I spoke to Rahil Raza, president of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow.
Well, the question that we have to ask ourselves, and actually the whole world needs to ask, is what is the basis behind this idea of denying girls education? It just hasn't come out of the blue. You know, there's got to be some foundation that's supporting it. And that is the interpretation of Sharia that the Boko Haram terrorists practice. And that is the interpretation of Sharia law that many parts of the Muslim world, Muslims practice. And under this, one part of it is that women should not get equal education. You know, I come from Pakistan, which is the land of Malala Yousafzai. This young girl who was shot in the face by the Taliban because she wanted to get an education. So the Boko Haram, in my perspective, are the Taliban of Africa. They follow the same ideology, the same twisted, violent interpretation of Sharia law.
So how do you counter that ideology? Because it's one thing if you are dealing with people who exist for violence, destruction and monetary gain. But, this is an ideological war.
Absolutely. And that's an excellent question because for far too long, we have been trying to fight this war of ideology by, weapons, which doesn't work. You know, this is a war of the minds. And the first part of the people who have to actually be involved in this war is Muslims themselves, because this is something that comes from within the faith and it impacts us. I was on a one-hour discussion with Islamic scholars this morning, and I was trying to convince them exactly, you know, they kept going back to say, well, you know, there are some very noble aspects of Sharia. That's all very well. You know, it is moral and ethical guidance, but we have to look around us, and from Brunei to Nigeria to Iraq to Pakistan, the kind of Sharia that is being imposed forcibly on civilians, and especially women, is inhumane. It's cruel. It's barbaric. And it's a 7th century law, which was frozen in time, now being forced upon people in the 21st century. So I give the analogy that it's like trying to force a VCR tape into a modern DVD player. It just doesn't work. So what has to be done is that there has to be a great deal of discussion and debate within Muslim scholars, within the Muslim world, about how they can reject some of these aspects of Sharia that are being practiced in the name of Islam. But let me backtrack. Before that, there has to be an awareness that we have a problem.
Rahil, I'm sure you've seen the footage that's been played out over the last few days involving those young women
dressed with the Muslim veil, chanting a Muslim prayer under the control of Boko Haram. There have been some reports that some of those young women have been recognised by family or friends as those abducted from the school several weeks ago. Can you give us an idea of what that conversion process, the conversion from, we understand many of those young girls were Christian, they've now undergone a conversion to Islam. Can you explain what that process under Boko Haram will have involved?
Well, it's a frightening thought, really. First of all, the idea that they need to forcibly convert these girls, which perhaps was the aim behind this whole abduction. You see, this is why I'm saying that it's not as simple as just education. There is a larger agenda here. There is a larger ideology at stake, an example to be given to other people in Nigeria that this is what we do to your girls. Now, under the interpretation of Sharia law that the Boko Haram follow, and by the way, the leader of the Boko Haram is well educated and well informed about Islam, like he is an Islamic scholar in his own understanding. So, you know, there's no gray area about thinking that this is happening under any other ideology. And they may force them into slavery. They justify this under certain aspects of Sharia law. They may forcibly marry them. And now there is one particular aspect. If a girl is raped, she has to marry her rapist. And this is why this is so frightening and appalling. And I wonder and worry whether perhaps female genital mutilation has been performed on these girls. We don't know this, but it is a practice that exists in Africa. And if they have forced them to convert to Islam, who knows what other aspects of their ideology they may force on them.
Rahil Raza, President of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow. This is FSN Reports. President Obama is getting regular briefings on a number of cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome that have been diagnosed in the United States. Two patients, one in Indiana and another in Florida, tested positive for the MERS virus in recent days after travelling from Saudi Arabia. Now, a hospital worker in Florida is also in isolation after treating one of the MERS patients. Our correspondent Steve Mort is in Orlando and spoke to me earlier.
Like the first detected in Indiana was found in a traveller who'd arrived recently in the US from Saudi Arabia, which is currently experiencing an outbreak of the virus. Dr. Antoni Crespo from the Dr. Phillips Hospital here in Orlando says that the 44-year-old man was admitted when he visited an emergency room with fever and chills.
He took a plane from Jeddah to London, and while on the plane, he started to have some muscle aches. That was his first symptom.
Now, the first US MERS patient in Indiana was released from hospital on Friday and is recovering at home, but is being kept isolated to prevent the spread of the virus.
Steve, the latest patient travelled on several flights to get to Orlando. What are health officials telling those who might have been on the same flights?
Well, medical professionals have been working to test everybody who was in contact with the patient and was at risk of contracting Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control is currently investigating this case, as are officials with the Florida Department of Health. And CDC Director Tom Frieden says his agency is working to prevent more cases from arriving on U.S. shores.
CDC has quarantine stations at all of the major airports of entry in the U.S., If someone has symptoms, we are immediately contacted. If need be, we will go on board the plane.
Now, it's worth bearing in mind, though, that experts say close personal contact is required and that the testing is out of an abundance of caution rather than a significant fear that people may be in danger. Nonetheless, the virus can have deadly symptoms if not treated the right way, including a high fever and breathing problems.
And in Saudi Arabia, what are health officials saying about the state of the outbreak there?
Well, the Centers of Disease Control here in the US is sending a team to Saudi Arabia to work alongside international health workers to help with this outbreak. It's understood that MERS first emerged in the region on the Arabian Peninsula in 2012. And although the outbreak is concentrated in Saudi Arabia, cases have been reported in 17 countries where there have been more than 500 cases, and around a third of those contracting the virus have died. But health officials do say that if treated right away and treated correctly, the survival rate is very high.
Steve Mort in Orlando, Florida. Now, seven Ukrainian troops have been killed in an ambush in the country's eastern region of Donetsk. According to reports, the soldiers were attacked by armed insurgents, resulting in a deadly firefight. The incident comes a day after Donetsk asked Russia to absorb the region following Sunday's referendum to break from Ukraine. The vote was branded illegal and illegitimate by Kiev and the West. For more on how Russia will react to the events of the last 48 hours, I spoke to international security expert Keir Giles from London think tank Chatham House.
Certainly there's always a chance there may be an invasion, but we have been saying right from the very beginning that it's a very slim chance, because to achieve Russia's longer-term aims for Ukraine, even just annexing Crimea was sufficient. Because if you consider that what they really want is to make Ukraine ungovernable without Russian consent, and therefore prevent any possible future accession to the EU, to NATO, any possible move further westward by Ukraine, then they've actually achieved that already simply by taking Crimea. Anything in addition is simply a bonus.
Right, so now Vladimir Putin will be sitting there looking at the results of the weekend, and he'll be thinking to himself, I now have that element of control to influence policy in the broader Ukraine?
Well, in fact, he didn't need the referendum for that, because the OSCE so-called roadmap that was presented before the weekend, which prompted him to say that actually the referendum was not necessary, already gives Russia what Putin wants, because it specifies that there should be an all-Ukraine dialogue on the future constitution, on the future setup of how Ukraine works, including the separatists. Now, that's a win-win situation for Russia, because not only is it exactly what they've been asking for all along, but it also allows Moscow to hold the government in Ukraine to international agreements which the separatists don't have to observe. So, in fact, they'll be able to blame Kiev for anything that happens from now on.
So is this Vladimir Putin potentially presenting this face of a good guy to the international community? Is that what we're seeing? Is that going to work?
That's exactly it. He can now ease off the pressure and pretend to be the good guy, pretend to be the moderate, because he has already achieved what he wants. So a lot of Western media actually fell for it, interpreting this statement by Putin that the referendum should not take place and the presidential election, the official presidential election, was a step in the right direction, interpreting that as a U-turn or a climb down, which is exactly what he wanted, even though it is nothing of the kind. In fact, the Russian position has not changed at all.
So if Vladimir Putin's image is coming out better from this latest chapter in the Ukrainian crisis, could he enhance that with further confirmation that his troops along the Ukrainian border have been withdrawn?
To the most recent information that I've seen, that hasn't actually happened. But once again, it did wrong foot a lot of the people who were watching and listening to what he was saying in the West into assuming that this was actually a compromised position by Putin and he had backed down.
And lastly, how will the Ukrainian government react to the events of the last 48 hours? What do you think their next move will be?
I think it's still rather a delicate position and a little hard to say what the next move will be. There are things happening rather quietly along those border areas where the loyalties of the majority of the population are not entirely clear. So, for example, while there's been a referendum on secession in effect in those eastern provinces, parts of those eastern provinces have also been asked whether they wish to secede from the provinces themselves. So it's a very mixed picture, and really things will only start to settle, I think, over the next 24, 48 hours. But we'll see exactly how people are responding both to the immediate aftermath of the referendum result and to these new EU sanctions that have been announced against Russian leadership figures.
Keir Giles from London think tank Chatham House. The European Court of Justice has delivered a ruling for Google to remove search content on individuals in the interests of personal data protection. It's being known as the Right to be Forgotten test and was brought to the court by a Spanish man who said a Google search of his name revealed an auction of his repossessed home 16 years ago and that that was an infringement of his privacy. I discussed the story with our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock in Brussels.
Indeed, it is something of a surprise for Google. When this case was referred up to the European Court of Justice by the Spanish national authorities, the ECJ's Advocate General Nilo Jaskinen said that he thought perhaps Google wasn't responsible for the data carried on its websites, as it's a search engine, so it's a carrier of this information and not actually the originators of it. So when that happened, it seemed that Google would win this case. But the ruling today is in direct contradiction with that idea, that opinion. And now, obviously, this is going to open up the doors for other cases of this nature, this right to be forgotten case.
And what's Google's reaction been to the result?
So clearly, Google are very disappointed with that expectation that they might win it. Previous to the case, they said that being obliged to delete such data that is in the public domain, that is openly available for anybody to see, would actually account to censorship. And obviously, Google wants to be as broad and as widespread as possible. So for them, this is a real problem. The question now is actually how far this case will allow other cases to be brought in front of the European Court of Justice.
Jack, has this been a popular ruling with the European Union?
So within the European institutions, the Commissioner, Viviane Reding, she proposed this right to be forgotten idea back in 2012. And she's tweeted that she's very happy about this ruling and that it's a positive step for the protection of personal data. But in the member states, there is some dissent. The UK Ministry of Justice has said that they are unlikely to adopt this rule. They are likely to opt out of it. But what will happen now is that the companies will now analyse the implications of exactly what this is going to mean internationally.
So can you explain what the global significance of this ruling is and whether it will have wider reaching effects?
Well, this is the point. Now that this case has been won, it could open the floodgates for many more cases, people not wanting things about themselves to be published online or to be openly available, even if it wasn't perhaps against the law, even if that information is in the public domain. They could now be bringing further cases, and it's unlikely to just be against Google. It could be against other big American internet giants. But also what it could do is set a precedent internationally. But really, the details of what this case is going to mean will be played out over the next few months, and we'll see exactly the implications that it's going to have.
Jack Parrock in Brussels. Finally, tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the great Nintendo gay marriage scandal. Last Friday, the Japanese manufacturers of Nintendo were forced to apologise for not recognising same-sex relationships in a popular video game that allows players to simulate real life. The game is called Tomodachi Life, and it was launched in the US last month. A Nintendo video announced its arrival in the marketplace.
In Tomodachi Life, you can create virtually anyone you can think of, and then interact with them in hysterical ways while they go about their daily lives on a small island. They move in, meet up, they become friends, they fall in love.
But they can only fall in love in Tomodachi Life if they are a man and a woman. There's no way for any kind of LGBT relationship to take place in the game. Ian Steadman is the science and technology writer with Britain's left-leaning New Statesman magazine. He spoke to fellow gamer Anoush Chakalian.
There is this Nintendo game on the 3DS handheld called Tomodachi Life, which is kind of like The Sims. You know, you have a character called Mi. You live your life on this little island. You're walking around. You make friends with other characters. You play games and you earn money and all kinds of that kind of thing. But you have relationships. It's one of those games where you build relationships with other players. And part of that is you can, like The Sims, get married, fall in love and get married with other characters and have children and all that kind of stuff. And it's all lovely. But you can't do it if you want to get same-sex married. which has caused a little bit of consternation amongst, say, amongst the LGBT community in North America and Europe.
So just to clarify, it's not, it wouldn't affect any storylines or anything like that.
It would.
It's just, ah, okay.
Yeah, there are certain parts of the game that you can only unlock after you've got married to another character. This is part of the critique. There's this guy called Tay Marini. He's a gay man living in Arizona who made this video explaining why he felt so let down by Nintendo. He wanted to marry his real-life fiancé's in-game me, but he realized the only way to do that would be to have a virtual sex change operation to change his me to a woman, or his fiance's one to a woman. And he didn't want to do that. He was like, why can't I just get married to my fiance's me, understandably, because then we can have kids, we can get a bigger house, we can move to a different island. There's all this stuff that comes
unlocked. Much like real life.
Much like real life, where you get these extra legal privileges. Yeah.
From a Nintendo's point of view, though, how would it be just literally a case of changing a few pronouns and unlocking a few avatars? Or would they be able to defend this on the basis that you'd have to kind of completely rewrite the game from scratch?
Their defense has been that it's not in the original code in the Japanese version. They don't have same-sex marriage in Japan, it's worth saying, and it's quite a conservative culture compared to North America and Europe in that regard. But they've said that because they've localized the game to North America and Europe, but it's not going to be included in that. It's worth saying that Marini is playing the Japanese version of the game. It's not out till June in North America or Europe. So there is still theoretically time to like change it, although it might be too late. And you can also patch games these days after they come out. So that's something that could happen. But instead, Nintendo's words were just that they didn't want to offer any kind of social commentary with the game.
Which is classic, because the idea that you make any kind of neutral decision. Yeah,
the choice of not choosing is in itself a choice. This has angered quite a lot of people. There was already quite a large social media campaign called MeQuality, which was having a lot of people tweeting that and stuff. And now it's much bigger because Nintendo have actually responded to it and in the negative. And what seems like quite like it's an open goal, they could quite easily change it, surely. And they've said no.
But to be positive for a moment, can you think of games that have interesting attitudes or positive depictions of homosexuality or allow you...
Final Fantasy IX has a gay
marriage?
Skyrim has gay marriages in it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Mass Effect.
Mass Effect, famously.
You can be what gender you want as Commander Shepard and then have relationships with various crew members. And I think that's actually... The way that Mass Effect does it, I think, is very good because you have straight characters in there who will only relate to you if you're one character. But and you also have a race that doesn't really care.
Yeah.
The Asari who are just, you know, who just like people who aren't other Asari.
Yeah, exactly.
It turns out.
Sims 3 does.
And Fable as well. Yeah. I had a lot of wives in Fable.
Oh, yeah. I only played Fable 1 and I remember marrying and killing my wives. I was a terrible teenager in retrospect in that regard. Sims 3, they actually introduced gay marriage it was something that was so frequently modded into the game by players in Sims 1 and 2 that they just had to bring it in eventually. It was just pointless not to.
I think things like these often reveal how slowly, along a lot of different axes, the game industry changes. Because I was thinking again last night about Mass Effect. Randomly thinking about Joker, the character in there, who is the pilot of the ship that you pilot, and is revealed to be, he has brittle bone disease, I think, and actually you only ever see him sitting down, and then you realise that if he would be in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And it suddenly reminded me that this is something that the games industry has not even touched in an interesting way.
Well, they've probably touched it better than representation of ethnic minority lead characters, for instance, or disabled lead characters. Yeah. I mean, it's as slim pickings as it is for the LGBT community.
That's Anoush Chakalian and Ian Steadman of Britain's New Statesman magazine. It's online at newstatesman.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Wednesday, Britain's evolving divisive relationship between religion and art. That's Wednesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.